Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Stock market, wealth, personal finance, value stocks. Invest in your life.
Hello, Smart Money Tree Podcast listeners. Welcome to this week's show. My name is Kirk Chisholm, and I will be your host today. So today, we have a good friend of mine, Andrew Stotz. How are you doing today, Andrew?
Good to see you and everybody out there.
Yeah, glad to have you on the show. I know it's hard to get you. You're on the other side of the world, and I'm sure I am to you, as far as I know, unless you would think the world's flat. So it's great to have Andrew on the show. Andrew runs a phenomenal podcast called My Worst Investment Ever. Loved being on his show recently. It was a great episode. We talked about everything under the sun, including inflation. He just has a phenomenal way of running a podcast. So Andrew, why don't you kind of give the listeners a little background outside of the fact that you're a famous podcaster?
Well, actually, I am officially the worst podcast host of my worst investment ever. So if I'm famous for anything, it's for being the worst. Just to give a quick background, I grew up in Ohio and I moved to California. And when I graduated university, I went to work for Pepsi. And then after a few years of doing that, I moved to Thailand in 1992 to teach finance. And I never left. So I've been here for 30 years. So I've worked always as an American in Asia here in Thailand. And so nowadays I do strategy and investment strategy. And also I have some businesses on the ground, in particularly a coffee roasting factory here in Thailand. And so I've had a lot of experience on the ground here in Asia. And I did my PhD in finance in China. I graduated when I was 50 years old. So I've kind of been around a lot, but I think what I've enjoyed a lot is interviewing. I've now interviewed more than 600 people about their worst investment ever. And I've come up with six, being an analyst like yourself and thinking about things in a structured way, I've come up with six common mistakes that maybe would be valuable for your audience to hear.
Yeah, do tell. Don't keep us in suspense here.
It's an open loop. Well, I'll start off with the first one, and I think these are in rank of most common, with the first one being the most absolutely common, and that is people fail to do their research. And even some of the smartest people I've met, you know, just put research aside and they jump into something. And so what I like to tell people is, you know, sit down, write out what you're thinking about this particular investment, you know, spend some time. And I think that's where a lot of people lose their money real fast, by just jumping into something without research. So that is literally number one. So for anybody listening or viewing, basically what you want to do right now is think about the investment you have in front of you and grab a piece of paper, have a cup of coffee, and start to write down. And also, I think I would highlight that that research doesn't need to be like super in depth. Otherwise, you could feel overwhelmed, like, you know, it's just too much for me right now. But just a little bit of research can go a long way.
Yeah, I have to agree with that. I totally support the fact that that is definitely number one. I think there's way too many people out there that just, they do a second's worth of research and they're like, oh, well, so-and-so said it's okay. It must be fine, right? And Wall Street is littered with people that are on the undercarriage of cars that have been driven by people who are blowing smoke, and Wall Street all the time, the big investment banks. Oh yeah, we fully support this and we're not selling it on the other side.
Boom. Like, yes.
It's like, oh yeah, we're going to sell this to the retail guys so that the institution guys can sell to them. It's crazy, but totally agree. People don't do enough research.
It happens all the time. And the funny thing is I've interviewed some people that are real professionals and then they didn't do their research on this particular thing. I have a friend of mine that I interviewed. He was the head of the CFA Society of Pakistan. So he is a very smart guy when it comes to finance and investing and with his clients' money. But somehow, someone that called him and said, we've got some really impressive land for sale in London, outside of London, that's going to be super valuable. And within a couple of weeks, he transferred £12,000 and never saw it again. So do your research.
All right. Number two.
Number two is failed to properly assess and manage risk. So I'd like to separate, and this is where I would tell a story about this, and that is that in my coffee business, we have expanded across Thailand. We supply coffee shops, restaurants, hotels, things like that. So we're a B2B business. And we recently had an opportunity to expand to Vietnam. And so my business partner, Dale, basically went to Vietnam, gathered all this information, and we agreed that we would meet after a period of time that he did his research on it. And he gave his presentation, but the agreement of his presentation in our meeting was he would only talk about the upside potential. So he presented what is the revenue potential in Vietnam. And it was okay, but you know, coffee consumption is pretty low in many countries in Asia. So it's not like it's anywhere near what we would expect in, let's say, the West. So we went through that presentation and then we went out and had dinner and talked more about other things. And then a week later, we had our second meeting. And it was a meeting about risk. And that was by separating the research that we do on risk versus return, it allowed us to dig in deeper into the risk without all the emotional attachment. And in the end, we decided that for the allocation of our resources, both time, energy, and capital, it was better to expand here in Thailand without all the risks of a foreign country and all that. So I try to help people think about separating your research you're doing on return from the research you're doing on risk. And that's how I help people try to overcome this idea of failed to properly assess and manage risk.
I love that because I think that most people just focus on return and they don't focus on risk at all. I think separating them is genius. I always look at manage risk first and the performance will take care of itself. Obviously, you have to do your work and the performance or else you won't get any, but that's easier because people don't want to. I think our natural, well, I shouldn't say this, but optimists, people who are optimistic are naturally optimistic and they're focused on the upside and not focused on the downside. You know, there's plenty of pessimists that focus on the downside, never the upside, but frankly, they're probably not in the stock market because they're afraid that the sky is going to fall. But I think getting that balance is really difficult and very, very few people do it well. You know, even notable examples.
You know, in that statement, I say fail to properly assess and manage risk. And the second aspect is, what do you do when things go wrong? I would say I'm so focused on risk management that I think about these things. And after all the stories, it really helps me to think that everything that you bought, you own, every allocation of energy can go wrong. Now, that doesn't mean you don't do it. But most people go into things never imagining that it could go wrong. And therefore, they're a deer in the headlights when it does go wrong. To give an example, some people decide to use a stop loss. And they buy a stock at 100 and they say, if this goes down to 75, I'm going to use that as validation to say, I was wrong and I'm going to sell. Now, that goes against the principles of a lot of people, but from my perspective, that's just a great example of a way of planning ahead. What am I going to do if things go wrong here? And it's not just stocks, it's investment. In my worst investment ever, people talk about the investment of time in relationships, investment of energy, in partnerships, in business, and stuff like that. So plan before you go into something what you're going to do if it goes wrong. And that's critical. So that's number two. And how about number three?
All right.
Driven by emotion or flawed thinking. I started to dig deeply into all the emotional mistakes that we make and the behavioral mistakes that we make. And you just realize like it's an endless list of mistakes and all kinds of fallacies and all kinds of things that we do. So I decided to bring both these emotion and thinking into the same thing. And basically what this means is that many people get excited. I mean, when you see a good investment, that's naturally what's going to happen. And it's not just, again, an investment in stock. It could be an investment in a relationship. It just could be a house that you got emotionally excited about. Also, there's plenty of people that are not great at thinking through things carefully. You know, if you've ever played somebody that's an expert in chess, as an example, the skill is really the ability to think many steps ahead. But there's plenty of people that get on a chessboard and they don't think more than one step ahead. And so what I really highlight to people is try to get opposing views and discuss your ideas with people who have opposing views, who are knowledgeable and are objective. And I have a friend of mine, and man, he tears down my ideas so brutally. I'm in a pile of tears by the time I get done talking with him and I don't feel like doing anything. Well, he's just like really a master at breaking down some of my emotional and thinking flaws. So in that way, he's super valuable. So look out for somebody that can just cut right through your emotional BS and your flawed thinking. And that's how you solve this one from my perspective.
Number four,
misplaced trust. This is just like the weirdest one where basically people just, they're the most hard charging people at work, demanding really tough contracts and terms, and they're pushing their suppliers to the limit. And then a stranger walks up and says, "Hey, I got an opportunity." And then they go, "Boop, here's my money." It's just like so amazing. It's obviously they didn't do any research, but it's a completely different thing. It's like somehow there are very masterful people out there that can grab you and get your trust immediately, even though it's a scam in many cases. And so this misplaced trust is number four. And I try to tell people, take time to get to know the people that you're investing with, because, and remember that trust can only be built over time. There is no secret. There is no shortcut to building trust. It only comes through observing someone's behavior through difficult times. So watch those strangers that come up to you asking for your money, but they're much more crafty than that in the way they do it. I just had a guest on who basically was, he started trading in Forex with this offshore company, and he was started making really good money. And then all of a sudden he lost it all. He ended up losing $56,000 in Forex trading. And then he went into negative, and the company contacted him and said that he needed to pay them and top up something or whatever. And then once he investigated, he realized that it was a complete scam. He was never trading in Forex, and his money was never put into Forex. He was just giving his money to this company who was taking it. If he had ever asked for, when he was up $110,000, if he had ever asked for his money back, he would have never have gotten it. And it's just hilarious how we can be so easily deceived.
It's funny, Wall Street, it's storied with how many people have had this happening. Bernie Madoff is the most popular one, but this happens, especially in Forex, it happens all the time. Or cryptocurrency, right? There's another one. Happens way too often.
Oh, yeah. Basically, what I always tell people is if you have anybody ask you to trade in Forex, just assume it's either a scam or a losing proposition. What I mean by losing a proposition is, you know, you're betting against banks and huge amount of capital, and you're betting against central banks. So very, very difficult to win. Number five, failed to monitor their investment. A good example is, you know, you give someone some money for a startup company to start a restaurant or whatever that thing is, and then you never follow up with them. There's no communication going on, and then things go south and you don't even know what's going on. This one I've seen very often. And what I would say is what you want to do is set up some type of predetermined. Let's imagine that somebody came to you with a really good idea. They wanted to open a Greek restaurant in a neighborhood where they didn't have a Greek restaurant, but they had a lot of traffic. They found a good location and it looks like this is potential. And you say, I'm going to give them $20,000 to do this. What I would do before I give them money is I would say, I want to meet with you on the 15th of every month. And what I want to do is review the financial performance of the company. I want to see what is particularly, we'll start with revenue and then later we'll go into the cost. But I want to see that every single month. Many people would agree to that before you give them money. So set some sort of predetermined monitoring of your investment so that you don't fail to monitor. And number six is kind of a catch-all category because I saw so many people lose their money this way. And that is they invested in a startup company. And everybody wants to be an owner of a company. It sounds great, but the fact is most of the time it's an absolute trap and it's really, really tough. And so what I like to tell people is when you invest in a startup, just go in with the idea that you're going to lose all your money.
I think that's a great starting point.
Yeah, it's a binary type of outcome. It's not like investing in the market. And chances are you probabilities are in your favor. In fact, when people ask me, can I talk to you about this idea I've got? Would you give me your idea? And I said, look, you don't even have to tell me about the idea. I can tell you my answer is no, don't do it. How do you even say that when you haven't even heard my idea? I said, the probabilities are like 80 to 90%. You're not going to succeed in this. So why would I even come up with a probability based upon, you know, something else like what you thought your idea was about? So that's where I just try to convince people to slow down before they go rushing into that.
I look at investing in startups like investing in lottery tickets.
Except that there's a potential you could win. With lottery tickets.
Well, you could win. You could invest in the next Facebook or Google or Microsoft. I mean, who knows?
That's the hope.
Anything could happen in the startup world.
Yeah, and that's the hope. The other piece of advice I give people about startups in relation to what I've learned on the podcast is I tell people, if you're going to invest in one startup, you need to invest in 10.
10 at minimum.
You know, do not invest in one. You've got to invest in a large number of them to increase the probability. And then people are like, well, I don't have enough money to do that. And I'm like, right. And that's why you probably need to wait until you can invest in 10.
I think startups are, it's this pie in the sky. Everybody wants to say they invested in the next X company and, you know, that company did great. And they were so smart that they picked it early. I'd be curious, has anyone ever run the odds of how much money you'd make in a startup versus a lottery ticket? I mean, I wonder what those odds are. I mean, it's 1 in 10 of making money, but then that's like a 3X, 4X, but when compared to the lottery, who knows?
Well, the statistics for business is really questionable because we'd like to say that maybe, I don't know, 10% of businesses make it 5 years or whatever, but that just is survival. To be truly successful in business, and as I say, if you're going to start a business, you need to make a rush to pay a dividend. Because ultimately, paying a consistent dividend is the best sign that you've made it. And so I would highly recommend to anybody to do that. And if we were to go through, Kirk, and look at all the businesses that survive 5 years and look at the number of them that are paying a dividend, I think you'll see that you're probably talking about 1% of all startups end up really succeeding to that extent.
But I think part of it is also that there's a lot of influence from the outside investors to not pay dividends. I remember talking to somebody a few years ago and they had a traditional, it was kind of more like a razor type of business. And you've got razors and you got razor blades. That's it. You're basically selling razor blades. And what I found to be interesting was that they said they were approached by a private equity firm. And they said, oh, what do you think this is worth? And they're like, oh, you're making money? They're like, yeah, they had really good cash flows. Everything was great. And they're like, oh, we're not interested in your company. You're making too much money. We want a company that's cash negative, is spending all their money in marketing. They're like, you need to spend more in marketing. Well, actually, we're profitable and it's a good company. It's solid. No interest. No VCs, private equity firms. They had no interest. They want companies that are losing money that they can give money to lose more money. So they can grow. And then it's like everyone's chasing that shiny object in tech land and they're not actually funding really good companies. And if they do, then they force them to spend more in marketing so they can grow. And it's like, well, how about you just do it right? Have you analyzed whether we're doing it right? So to me, it seems like there's misaligned incentives on the investor side right now.
From a person who started up a few different businesses myself, and I was an analyst in the stock market for 20 years at investment banks. What I would say is don't listen too much to investors. They're talking about their own interests completely. And in this case, you know, you've got so much money swishing around at 0% interest rate for so long that basically everybody was throwing good money after bad. But I think part of that's going to get worked out. But I think the best type of situation is if I was an investor in a company, I would say start paying a dividend of 5% of your net profit. If you're a startup, just a 5% payout. So 95% you're retaining in the business. But it's just the act of getting to a dividend is just one of the most powerful things. Of course, if you happen to start that business and after a few years you realize, geez, we've got the next Microsoft. Microsoft didn't pay a dividend for what, the first 25 years or so? And their return on invested capital was about 40%, maybe 30 to 40%.
Does that include the bomber years where they pretty much torched? Somebody's telling me, it's like, yeah, we account for them torching like, you know, $10 billion a year in cash. So we just assume they're going to light it on fire. I'm like, okay. It's still a cash cow.
It's possible. I would say the main thing is obviously if you've got a high return on invested capital company, you know, yeah, you want to plow back everything you can as long as you think future returns are going to be above your cost of capital at least. And so, yeah, there's that. But I would say the discipline and the goal of a startup company should be to pay dividend. One of the things that people ask me too in startups, because I do a lot of valuation and teach the valuation masterclass. And what I do is I basically, some people will ask me, how do I get a higher price when I want to sell my business? And I say the same advice, simple. I said, now this is simple. Double your salary today. And they were like, well, how is doubling my salary going to get me a higher price? I said, because when you double your salary, you're going to find out you're not making profit.
Yeah.
And when you've realized that you're underpaying yourself and your team, you're going to realize that you don't have an attractive company for a buyer. Because if a buyer was to take over your company, and then after that, you left that company that you started, the buyer is going to have to replace you and your management team at market prices, at market rates. And to do that would make the company unprofitable. And that's the most common mistake that people make when they think that they're going to get a good price for their company. So number one, make sure you're paying your team and yourself market rates. Number two, make sure you're paying a dividend. And that can make you really attractive to a sensible buyer.
I was on your show recently. It was one of my favorite interviews, external interviews I've had in a while. We talked a lot about inflation. You got my thoughts on your show. I want to get your thoughts. What do you think about inflation? Where do you think things are going? Start there and we'll dive right in.
If I look at U.S. inflation as a start, I would say that we're probably not going higher on U.S. inflation unless oil doubles from here. But what I think is going to happen is that we're going to stay high in the U.S. and that's because the impact of high oil prices now feeding through and all of that. So we're seeing core, we're seeing the housing, you know, the owner's equivalent rent and these types of things feeding in. So my expectation right now for US is pretty high inflation, and the impact of what the Fed's doing and all of its tightening will take some time to happen. Well, the other angle to inflation is that it's decimating the world outside of the US. And if we look at countries around the world, they're getting crushed from inflation. So America's like kind of cleaning up its house. It's had zero interest rate for so long that it's tightening right now, but it is really hurting, you know, countries like Sri Lanka, countries like Pakistan, countries like Bangladesh, Kazakhstan, even Argentina and some other countries. You can see massive amounts of inflation feeding through because they're also impacted by their currencies. With the US dollar being so strong, not only do you have just inflation, but then you have a deteriorating currencies around the world that's making it a disaster. So that brings me to the second part of inflation, and that is really the scarcity that's going on because of the war that's happening in Europe. And that scarcity, I think, is going to hit Africa the hardest, and it's going to be brutal. And it's going to mean millions of people dying of starvation and lack of food. There's estimates from some different groups that you have 50 to 100 million people that are going to be facing a severe situation when it comes to food. And so you've got to put this in global context, and the damage and the pain that's happening right now around the world from this tightening is going to be severe. And it probably is going to trigger even worse things coming.
I'm curious, when you're saying it'll hit Africa the hardest, and he'll probably be out by the time this episode comes up. We just interviewed an expert on agriculture and global food supplies. It's a very interesting interview, but we didn't talk about Africa. I would have thought Africa would have been able to self-feed their people. I don't know what their agriculture looks like, but are they importing food from other continents?
Definitely. There's a lot of imports. I mean, one of the problems that Africa is facing is that first, you know, you've got problems of water. You've got problems of productivity and efficiency of farms. And then you've got problems with fertilizer. So without fertilizer, which is mainly coming from Europe generally, and certainly Russia, a lot of gas imports, basically without that fertilizer, it's going to be devastating. So those are some different issues that they're facing. So it is a very serious problem. And we're already seeing inflation going quite high in some of these countries, but countries like Congo and some others that are really facing some serious risks. And then you've got countries that are just in kind of disarray, like Somalia, as an example, that just doesn't have the capacity to feed itself. So really what you're looking at is, you know, I'm in Thailand, and Thailand is pretty unique in the sense that it is a massive producer, but Thailand is almost a complete floodplain, meaning as soon as we get rains, it goes into the soil, and then our water table is always available for tapping into. So Thailand is an example of a very abundant water makes Thailand a very fertile place. But I think Africa's got problems with water, problems with the efficiency of what they're producing, and also problems with fertilizer. And these things are all going to come together with destabilization that happens when these types of things go on. And then add into it declining currencies and devaluing currencies. Africa is going to be the next real, real serious hotspot. And it's going to lead us into World War III, is my feeling. And that's my biggest concern.
All right. Well, that was a great segue into something we talked about earlier, which is World War II and a half and World War III. So what are your predictions around that? Is Russia going to cause it, or how are we going to get there?
So I would say that we have just gone through what I call World War 2.5. And the war was between the US and not Russia. I would say from an economic perspective, Russia is meaningless to the US. From a political perspective, Russia is meaningless to the US. So it wasn't a war between US and Russia. It was a war between US and Europe. And it was a perfectly executed war against Europe. And I reference Sun Tzu, who is one of the ancient Chinese experts on strategy. And he says the best strategy is one where you win the war without having any bloodshed or a battle. And I would say America has masterfully conquered Europe. And if you just look at a map of the flow of energy, oil and gas from Russia's heartlands into Europe, what America's done is severed that, and there is no supply of oil and gas in Europe that can replace that. And therefore, Europe has to now switch to either US, Middle East, maybe a little bit from Africa, but that's very difficult because there isn't the connections there for the distribution. So America has managed to get, and they did it in a masterful way that America did it, was they got the Europeans to cut off their own energy supply. America didn't have to do it forcibly. They just helped the Europeans to do it. So I would say, from an energy perspective, from an economic perspective, from a military perspective, and from a cultural perspective, the US has conquered Europe.
It's an interesting perspective. Certainly have not heard that from anywhere else.
The other thing that was interesting is that in 2015, the amount of refugees that went into Europe was about 1.5 million people. What were they fleeing? They were fleeing American-led disruptions and wars and destruction in Libya, in Syria, in Afghanistan, and other places. And basically, those people went from just absolute chaos into Europe. So in a sense, America lit a fire from far away, like threw a match from far away, and an explosion went up and hurt everybody. And so what I would say, too, is that America's tactics in this case end up causing a cultural issue, where no matter what your view is on immigration, to bring 1.5 million people into Europe from different cultures, different backgrounds, different religions, it causes some sort of disruption. Now, when you're looking at Ukraine, you're talking about more like 7 to 8 million people coming from Ukraine into Europe. Again, there are cultural disruptions that are happening in Europe. And Europe is starting to respond to it, but they're absolutely powerless now. European leaders in 2008 tried to stop America from forcing NATO to say that Ukraine and Georgia were going to be in NATO, but they couldn't stop America's influence on NATO. And so basically, it's over. Now, there's a very important reason why America must conquer Europe.
Do tell.
And that reason you can find on the website of the US Department of Offense, which I think they call it Department of Defense. I call it the Department of Offense.
I think they call it doublespeak in 1984.
Yes, exactly. Department of Defense has on their strategic plan, they're not identifying Russia as the number one target. They're identifying China as their number one adversary. In a sense, about 4 years ago, when they posted this strategy, they announced that they are now on a warpath with China, and they see China as their number one adversary. So what was happening was Europe was building closer ties with China through German manufacturers being in China and many different connections that was happening. So not only did the U.S. sever the ties between Europe and their source of energy, Russia, they also are doing everything they can to sever the ties with China. Now, why is it important to get Europe on the side of the U.S. unequivocally? Because the rest of the world is not buying into America's war with China. If we look at the sanctions and way countries are voting around the world, you can see countries in Africa, countries in Asia, and countries like India, as an example, they're not signing up for the sanctions. So in order for America to exercise its power to go after China, they've got to get Europe on their side at least to have that. And so that's what I see. And I would say it's a preemptive war where they're trying to knock down China before they become a real threat.
Well, that's some deep stuff. I can say that as I've thought about this, I have not thought about it. That's like 5 or 6 steps ahead of the game. So I appreciate the perspective. And certainly the U.S. war against China is coming. And I don't think anybody denies that. I mean, this is interesting because I've always looked at the U.S. is a little bit heavy-handed in their international affairs. And what I see is China, I mean, most countries are not, they don't have the same strategery that the U.S. has. But out of all the ones I've noticed, they seem to be the most strategically adept out of any country, including us. They're thinking in decades and hundreds of years, and we're thinking in like quarters and 12 months. I've seen a lot of the stuff they're doing, but I don't know how this is any different from when England was king of the world, if you will, with the reserve currency, but that didn't last forever. So it kind of makes me wonder, like, what is going to be the outcome of this? Because China's not going to take their foot off the gas. They're going to do whatever they want to do. Russia seems to be more of a natural ally for the U.S. than anything else, but yet, you know, we're enemies against them. Europe, I think, just doesn't want to get into another World War III, which I can understand. They've been through 2 of them. Things always centralize in Europe. And the rest of the world just kind of goes along and tries to stay out of their way. China seems very adamant of going in their direction, which is direct odds of our direction. So how does that end up working out?
First of all, I don't think that China wants to go direct odds to America. In fact, China could have been America's biggest ally. But if you look at the TPP partnership, the Trans-Pacific Partnership that America tried to set up, I don't know, 10 or 15 or 20 years ago, it was to build partnerships with countries in Asia to agree upon terms. And they excluded China. Right from the beginning, they could have had China as a potential friend. But it's just no way Americans are going to do that. And I think American politicians are just on a warpath. I would say from someone that's been in China and in America, I would say that China does not have as much power as it may appear. And I don't think that they have the desire to dominate the world. Whereas you can say America's got 800 military bases across the world and tries to influence countries and political systems everywhere that they possibly can. China is not necessarily an adversary that's trying to go after America. But I think that, unfortunately, that is a very unpopular thing to say for an American politician. And the result is that they just can't get off the warpath. And let's go back to Africa. Where is this going to happen? Where is World War III going to, where is the flashpoint for World War III? I would argue that the flashpoint is Africa, because when African countries start screaming for food and aid and support because of all the damage happened because of this war in particular, and then Fed policy, which is just strengthening dollar and all of that, basically what you're going to see is that when America goes to try to help Africa in its humanitarian way, it's going to find China's there. And China has tremendous economic influence now in many African countries. And the result of that is that America is going to all of a sudden realize, I like to describe it, Kirk, like that old girlfriend or boyfriend or whatever, you don't mind letting go of them. But when you see them with a new guy or a new girl, it's going to make you really get pissed off. I think that's the way America is going to respond. They haven't paid a huge amount of attention to Africa. And now all of a sudden they're going to see that the Chinese are there. And that is what's going to spark the need for Americans to say, we've got to act or else we're going to lose our control of the world economy.
to me, I feel like it seemed like a deliberate attempt to get out of Africa. It's been obvious that China has been stepping into the void that we've left. I'm certainly no more astute than anybody else, people that live this stuff. So they must already know that we're stepping out and they're going to fill the void. And why wouldn't they? They need resources. Africa has resources. There's certain things they need and they don't want to rely on us. And deglobalization is happening, which is causing all these countries to become self-sufficient. And there are many that can't. But the ones that are trying, China's low on a lot of stuff as we are. We're low on a lot of stuff in our country. And we've got access to lithium, but we don't want to mine it here because it's so dangerous. Nobody wants to touch the stuff. So, hey, let's go mine it in Africa. Let's go mine it in China. Let's mine it in Ukraine. Let's go find it anywhere.
Kazakhstan.
Yeah, Kazakhstan. Let's go anywhere that has it but the US, even though we have it. I find this stuff fascinating. It's like one big chessboard, like 3D chess. It's always aggravating because I think the rest of us kind of get carried along and none of us really care. We don't want World War III. I think if you kind of localize everything, people would be happy, but you got people trying to rule the world and I don't know. If they wanted to reduce population, that's certainly one way to do it.
The world is not trying to deglobalize. Only it's America right now that's trying to do that. Most other countries in the world need to trade and they want to trade. It is the US that has been aggressive at severing ties and trying to, particularly severing ties with China. And it's kind of interesting because when I grew up in America, it was about free trade and all of that. But now it's about using trade as a political tool, as a weapon, something like that. Things have changed. Just want to highlight one country. I mentioned Kazakhstan. I think for your listeners, just keep your eye on this country because it is, I think, a future hotspot. And the reason why it's a hotspot is because, first of all, it's basically in between Russia and China, number one. And below Kazakhstan is where America's been messing around with Afghanistan and also through the Middle East. You're looking at the countries that are below Kazakhstan. And Kazakhstan has a tremendous amount of resources, not just oil and gas, but rare earth elements. And those rare earth elements are critical not only for nuclear energy, but also for electric vehicles and all that type of stuff. And right now, they're pretty closely aligned with Russia, and most of their resources are going through Russia. America's got some focus on how do they get control of those and of the value of the assets there. And I think China also. So you've got a real potential showdown happening in Kazakhstan.
So Andrew, I know we've talked a lot about some heavy topics here and listeners been around this show long enough know we're not shy from talking about heavy topics, but I do always like to leave with some brighter spots and some shiny, bright future. So tell us where the opportunities are. We talked about all the dark spots, but where are some opportunities? Because this is an investing show and we want to make money. What can you tell listeners what they should be looking for?
Well, the first thing is investing capitalism. It's one of the most optimistic, positive things that has ever happened in the whole world. Entrepreneurship, setting up businesses, running businesses. There's just so many great businesses around the world. So that's the first thing I would say. It's politics and politicians that bring us division. Business, entrepreneurship, startups that bring people together. So the first thing is make sure that you're focusing your energy on business. Now, when I look at that, obviously America's done so well over the past 10 years in we're at peak profit margins right now across the world. So part of what I'm looking at now is where are things getting cheap again? Because markets have been so brutal. I've just been looking across the world, but I would say that ASEAN, Association of Southeast Asian Nations in the Southeast Asian region, I think is interesting where you've got 600 million people or so in this region where it's not caught up in the war and forced to choose sides at this point. A lot of food independence. So I think some of the countries in Southeast Asia are looking interesting. So that's kind of an area that I've been focusing on. From my perspective, I have been interested in the US and I just think that we probably have another maybe 10 to 20% downside. But at some point, you know, what US has done so well is continue to rejuvenate its economy and its businesses. I think that ultimately the U.S. will be a powerhouse. And I just wish that America would spend more resources on just building up its own infrastructure rather than trying to destroy infrastructures around the world. So I would say for me, Asia and emerging Asia in particular, particularly Southeast Asia, look interesting at this point. And then I would argue that at some point, America is going to rise again as far as the companies are concerned.
Appreciate your insight, Andrew, and love having you on the show. And quite frankly, we'd probably have you more on the show if you weren't 12 hours ahead or behind. So
great to be on.
But Andrew, where can people find more about you?
Just go to myworstinvestmentever.com, and there's where I have my podcasts. And you can also reach out to me there, and also just go listen to the podcasts on Apple or any other podcast providers that you're listening to. It's not much competition out there for the worst. So just type in my worst investment ever and you will find me.
Is inflation getting you down? Do you feel like your money is worth less every time you open your wallet? Is shrinkflation frustrating you at the grocery store? Well, I have an answer for you. We're giving away free money. That's right. I said it. Free money. I feel like I'm not doing my job to create inflation. Why does the government get to have all the fun? What can be better at increasing inflation than giving away free money? No, I'm not an employee of the Federal Reserve. And no, I'm not an employee of the U.S. government. And no, I am definitely not printing it myself. But it is free. What more could you ask? Well, you might ask, is the money real? Well, yes, it is. It's totally real. I'm holding it in my hands right now. See? Oh, wait, actually, this is a podcast. You really can't see me. Well, either way, I'm holding it in my hands right now, and I want to give it to you. If you want some free money, please go to moneytreepodcast.com/free money. Follow the instructions and I'll mail some to you. Enjoy your free money today. I'm not with the Federal Reserve, so I only have a limited supply. This offer is good until I run out. Go to moneytreepodcast.com/free money today to get your free money. As we get into the panel portion of the show, this week we have our very own Doug Hagren. Hey, Doug.
Hey, Kirk. Good morning. Welcome. Good to see you again. Hope you're going to be planning for a great holiday. Not only you, but everybody else listening. A couple more days until we get, I don't know if the crazy ends or the crazy starts, but wherever you are, best wishes and happy holidays to you.
Thanks, Doug. And I'm pretty sure the crazy never stops, whether it's me or someone else. This crazy is everywhere. And those of you who are watching on YouTube, you probably noticed my attire. It's because I'm doing a little work on my winter pool, which I'm going to be talking about on LinkedIn. We also have our very own Barb Freeberg. Hey, Barb.
Good morning. Happy to be here.
So let's just dive right in. So, Doug, what are some of your thoughts from the interview with Andrew?
So we talk about the five different things he talked about, right? So make sure you do your research or failure to do your research. Make sure that you assess and management, think about risk, the understanding of limiting emotion in your decision-making, misplaced trust. So again, somebody who's totally caught up with discipline and rigidity and systems. And then all of a sudden, you know, somebody comes along and they just trust them willy-nilly. Failure to monitor. And then, of course, I love the catch-all, like investing in startups. I'm going to summarize, and we'll talk a little bit more of this in detail, Kirk. But to me, one of these is a perfect example of the irrational exuberance, I use that word from the past, that has occurred here in, if not the last couple of years, without a doubt, the last 18 months. 18 months preceding what has occurred with a little bit this year that kind of proves some of those examples. You know, when we start talking about things like cryptocurrency, NFTs, no matter what happens, the stock market goes up mentality. I mean, there are some imperfect examples of how trusting people without any logic, not monitoring your investments, not thinking about the worst that could come, not doing any research or having any research, trusting celebrities and their opinions, getting overly emotional about the opportunity there without thinking about what could happen, and ultimately investing in a startup. These are startups. We didn't know what NFTs were 5 years ago. We didn't know what crypto was 5 years ago. I think those are incredible examples just in a short period of time of how across the board, people have failed to put together those triggers that I think he makes a really good point. And I'd like to call it common sense, but he has to talk about it because common sense doesn't exist. It's common lack of sense out there, which unfortunately leads to the same kind of situations that repeat themselves over and over. And we're starting to see that with a lot of people when you hear about people selling condos and investing everything they can into some sort of new technology or new startup. You know, if we can just remember that when the times are good and actually understand how history repeats itself, all of these things go into the way you should be thinking about every decision you make. And unfortunately, that's something I'm not sure that as a whole, people will fully ever grasp.
Well, as Warren Buffett said one time, the one thing we learn from history is that we don't learn from history. We can all hope for that, but I'm pretty sure that's a lesson that won't carry over. So, Barb, what are your thoughts? What are some of your takeaways from the interview?
I like Doug's summary. And one of the things that I want to pull out is FOMO, fear of missing out, is one of the biggest problems with investing today. I say this because I'm so old.
You're not old, Barb. You're wise.
With the advent of the internet and social media and Robinhood and Webull and all of these platforms and Reddit, what happens is our brain gets triggered when we see, in my feed, CNBC has this Making It vertical where there are articles about these. Doug, you're shaking your head. You've read it. There are articles about.
No, but I can imagine already what they were saying.
It comes into my feed. I don't even, subscribe or whatever. It's just there. But it's these articles about these young people under 30 who have made these gobs of money and doing who knows what. And it feeds your mind of thinking, oh my gosh, I've got to get in on the next thing. You read these, an NFT sold for $20 gazillion. I've got to get in on that before I miss it. Crypto is happening. There's crypto millionaires everywhere. And if I don't start investing, I'm never going to be a crypto millionaire. This kind of thinking can really screw you up. And the thing that you want to remember is, if it's a good investment, it's not going away. Okay? It's not going away. There will be opportunities later. So sure, if you want to be an early adopter, great. Do that. That could be in your personality or a big risk taker. Just don't do it with all your money.
There's a big challenge with all investors. And this has always been the way, whether it's the internet or crypto or whatever it is, or real estate. Everyone has this FOMO feeling, and I agree, it's one of the biggest problems that we have out there. So obviously, one of the things we try to talk about on the show is trying to educate people on how to think about things. And this is one of those mental frameworks that people really need to have. It's really hard. People are making money on meme stocks and crypto and NFTs, and it's so easy. A caveman could do it. And then people lose a lot of money, and then they get, upset because they didn't get in early enough. That's how you think about it. I'm human. I think about it the same way. Like, oh, I didn't get in early enough. Next time I'm going to get in early. But when you get in early, there's so many different trends that you don't know if they're going to pan out. I mean, I could tell you there were a ton of trends that I've looked at over the years, like nanotechnology. That was enormous. Where did that go? I mean, it's still there, but it's not the big trend that a lot of people thought it was going to be. There's a ton of these things. Every year, there's a new one that comes out. Some work, some don't. So you never really know, but I think people get caught up, seeing their friends get rich and they didn't. It's like going to the casino, right? You go to the casino and someone's winning. You're like, oh, I'm going to go to that table and play. Well, that's not going to cause you to win. It doesn't rub off because you're standing next to somebody. That's not how probability works. Maybe it does with tarot cards, but certainly not with,
Inside joke.
Inside joke. Sorry. Yeah. You guys have to see the pre-reel for this one. It certainly doesn't work with investing or gambling. So I think you just need to really kind of think about things independently, which I know is hard because we're herd animals in many ways. So you need to kind of think for yourself and don't be caught up in the FOMO because that'll cause you to lose a lot of money.
And do not believe everybody you see on the internet. Okay. There's no reason to prohibit someone from lying. Think Madoff. He conned so many people, smart people, informed people. So do your homework before you, first of all, invest in anything. And second of all, you see some Joe Schmo talking about how he made a gazillion dollars on XYZ. How do you know that's true? Have you seen his bank statement?
Are you saying that we shouldn't just believe everything Matt Damon says to us in a Super Bowl ad?
Tom Brady's ad was pretty cool, I have to say.
It was pretty cool. They're both pretty cool. Just a little bit on that, because again, I could go on each one of these and I could go so far on each one of these topics. But when you talk about social media, what you hear, I mean, one of the things he talked about on that emotional side, and you talked about FOMO, but it's that echo chamber, right? And social media is incredibly dangerous to this, because when you talk about the Twitters and the Reddits of the world, these softwares have algorithms that will pump to you exactly what you've been looking for and exactly what you believe, which are the nuances in the way you search them. So you create this echo chamber of, yeah, see, I know I'm right. Everything I'm reading is telling me I'm right. Correct. But this is the same thing as a smart business person or a smart politician or anyone whose ego becomes unchecked, who surround themselves with yes men. We all know from a conceptual standpoint, we all know that some of the worst things that you can do, or some of the worst leaders or people that we've listened to, people say, yeah, they surround themselves with the yes men. They just agree with everything they say and they just feed that ego, and that creates more and more rational decisions. We all know in concept that this is a bad thing, but yet hypocrisy happens everywhere and people do this and fall into this exact same trap. I loved exactly what he was talking about, where like one of his best friends just demoralizes his ego. He just destroys it. When he comes up with a great idea, he goes away and he wants to cry. But it's because of that that he creates subjectivity. It's because of that that he pauses for a second. One of the most important things you can do with any of this is pause for a second and really get to a logical standpoint of going back to research, going back to, do I trust this person? Trust builds over time. You know, the more time you take, now you can take too much, and he talks about being paralyzed. But you need to take a pause there. Separate, like he talked about in his one business. They'll talk about what we think can happen good in one day, and they'll leave the risk to another conversation so that you don't blend and muddy it all. It creates a logical approach, a pause, a process, God forbid. Now, I know you're not pushing stocks here. I'm just kidding. This is totally in jest. But obviously, Kirk, you're pushing Geico because you said it's so easy a caveman could do it.
They don't still advertise that.
They don't still advertise that. But, you know, it's still one of the best ad campaigns ever. It is. Oh, there you go. Yeah, exactly. You're offending the caveman. But ultimately, I'll also say that if it's good, it will be there as investment in the future. And I want to pause on that a little bit, because that goes back to the research, right? It goes back to understanding and looking at the risk, because Woolworths at one point was an incredible investment opportunity. It's gone. So just to kind of tackle on what Barb's saying, as a concept, as an index, as a category, then that is true. If it's good, it will be a good investment. That does not always trickle down to individual investments. Individual investments will always have risk, because somebody that might be the best player in a category might become an obsolete player in that category later. So again, continue to do your research, continue to do your logic. But that also goes back to one of the things he said is monitoring. Monitor it. Continue to understand what your limits are. Continue to understand what's going to go on. Like I said, I could continue on this for so long. There's so many incredible points that Andrew gets into. Man, if people would pause for a second to follow these five or six things, how many trails of tears would dry up?
If you think about AIG or GE, which were both AAA rated companies, and what happened to them? Oddly enough, they're both in the financial industry, which makes it easier for them to be less stable. But they're AAA rated companies, and you'd think, oh, they're stable. And you know, if you look back at history, I think GE was the last original Dow company. These are supposedly like the strongest companies out there over the years, and there's none left. They change.
Not everybody knows GE was Thomas Edison's company. He started General Electric. This is going back to basically the invention of modern industry. And look at it now.
And if you look at the history of the Dow, like the companies have changed over the years, it changes a lot. And a lot of these companies aren't around anymore. Some of them are, and they're just not as big. You know, like GE is no longer in there and they're not as big. But some are still around, but they've merged. They've gone out of business for various different reasons. So I think it's really important to understand, you know, these kind of risks and not just buy a stock and stick it in a safety deposit box, which you have been able to do in the past. That was a strategy, I forget the name, it was like the tin can investing. Basically, you buy a stock and you put it in a tin can, you leave it and you look at it like 50 years later.
What was the movie with Brandon Fraser? Remember, he goes the nuclear fallout, they go into the shelter and they come out like 30 years later. Do you remember that?
Idiocracy?
No, I'll look it up for you. But his dad is Christopher Walken, completely afraid of nuclear fallout. So there's a threat. They all go into the bomb shelter and they stay down there for 30 years. And when they finally emerge, One of the keys of that movie is at the end, they've got all this old stock from like 30 years ago that is now like ridiculous. I'll look it up for you. Continue. Sorry, Kirk.
No worries. Let's talk about some of the common mistakes. And then I want to get into the kind of the global aspect of investing, because I think that's really important. So Barb, what are some of the other mistakes that you see that people make? You mentioned FOMO, but any others that you see a lot?
Failure to assess the risk. I think we all get swept up in being so excited when we see a new investment. I have a story. I write for US News and Forbes Advisor and Investopedia. And some of my assignments are best lists of ETFs, best growth, best value, best, you know, all different sorts of best of lists of investing. And my process is I go and I do a screening, and then I do a mini kind of valuation on each one of these to pick what I think are the best based on objective criteria. So I do a lot of research. And so then I write up the article, gets published, blah, blah, blah. But are these the best investments for you? Do they fit into your portfolio? And for me personally, I see some of these investments and I'm like, this has such a great strategy. This is so wonderful. I wasn't even aware of this growth and value combination, which has a good dividend, good growth, outperformance. I've got to pick that one up. And so even I get swept up, or I'm interviewing someone about their new startup or investment company, and it sounds so good. But the problem with that is you need to look at the downside. What are the negatives? Any investment, any strategy, you can get really excited about the pros. But if you don't take a step back, put some time between that buy trigger that you place on your computer to say, oh, I've got to get this, and say, I'm going to step back and think about this. What's the worst case scenario? And can I tolerate that? Can you tolerate a 75% loss in a stock? I've had that. I don't know if you guys have, but I've been investing for 30, 40 years. Yeah, I've had a 75% investment. So you can't always look at the positive. You have to look at the negative, at the risk, and what is the potential loss. And then you have to ask yourself, if the worst case scenario happened, can I handle it? And should I do something like Andrew suggested, put a stop loss order in? So should I protect myself in some way? Investing in is not a one and done endeavor. Even if you have a financial advisor, you have to monitor your investments and you have to make smart decisions on your portfolio so that your general overall return will be positive.
In the interest of time, I want to get into the international aspect. Doug, obviously, Andrew talked a lot about global and Africa, and there's a lot of different aspects here. How do you kind of look at global investing? I mean, most people are home country centric. The US is very much home country centric. But if you actually look at all the other countries, they're actually the same, even though most of the global production and companies are based elsewhere, even though we're, I think, 40% of the global economy. Every other country is the same. They just might be smaller, but most of that productivity is outside of the country. Yet we all put the majority of portfolio domestically, which is not a problem, but we still need to understand there are other countries and companies out there. So how do you look at it?
I look at it for a number of things. I think you have to look at currency conversion. I think that matters. You know, if a country trades in US dollar currency, that's going to have some impact on the value of that, their ability to be able to keep their economy up in line with our economy. And of course, if they trade on the dollar, then they may have the ability to weather volatility in the dollar more effectively. If they trade in local currencies, then those local currencies are going to be much more sensitive to alternate currencies like the dollar globally and what that might have with the impact of inflation, conversion, the ability of purchase power. I look at kind of the mega caps of the international space. You know, I look at those kind of blended as kind of one unit. I know there's a difference between, obviously, if they're based in the United States or they're based outside, but, you know, look at things like Nestle. Nestle is an international company. It's a foreign company. But do I see a big difference between Nestle and M&M bars in terms of its potential performance? No, I think they're both going to dominate. They're going to be highly correlated under any kind of situation that might affect that category. The elevator is going to go up and down, and they're going to do pretty similar. But what I do think is that when you start to get outside of that, you start looking at emerging markets, you start looking at small mid-cap companies in the international space, just like here in the United States, they're going to be less consistent or less correlated to global activity and much more correlated to what's going on domestically at home. Here in the United States, we know that what affects 3M is probably going to be more tied to what's going on globally because 3M has a lot of global supply. If we have that unrest or that destabilization, or as he was talking about in his interview, famine, lack of food, lack of resources, a complete collapse of their economies, that is going to be a massive challenge for companies like 3M who have been relying on that increasing wealth of that middle class. If that increasing wealth of that middle class collapses, companies like 3M, but also Nestle, who also is a big global empire, they're both going to be impacted the same. Now, small companies in the United States, I'm not really concerned. As a small business owner, I am concerned about the overall economy. I'm not concerned what's going on in Europe. It has some impact, but it doesn't have a direct impact on what the economic outlook of my business is because my clients are here in the United States. They're under the US dollar. They're in the US economy. A company that's in Southeast Asia that only supplies, as he was talking about, inside Thailand, or a company in Italy that only sells in Italy, isn't going to be necessarily as concerned with what's going on across the world or their ability to have their business compromised by what's going on there because they are just selling locally. I mean, if the Italian economy is good, they're probably good. The Italian economy stinks, they're probably going to stink too. So that's real diversification because they have different influences and different factors that are going on there. And like he kind of alluded, now I don't know whether or not he's correct. So I want to preface where he's saying to invest, he might be dead wrong. Do your research. Don't get in the echo chamber. Let me see here. Don't get emotional. I mean, all of these things before you follow anything he was talking about. But if he's right, let's say Southeast Asia may be a good investment opportunity, but it's going to have a very different economic or investment opportunity than, say, investing in Africa or even investing in the United States. So to me, I think international is an incredibly good opportunity for diversification. But again, you have to really get granular on where you're investing, because if you're just buying a foreign company like Nestle, I don't think you're going to be diversifying very well. But if you actually understand what's going on locally around the world and the various factors that come into play, it can be. I will preface, this is one of the reasons that companies like Vanguard that love index funds have come out and said, index funds work in certain areas. They're great if you're going to do the S&P 500 or Global International, because those big companies stay those big companies. And, you know, there's not that many of them to pick from. So an active manager is going to have a hard time beating them. But when you start getting into fixed income and you start getting into foreign small companies or emerging markets where you've gone from hundreds of companies to thousands of opportunities and thousands of variables that can come into play, you really need someone that's doing all five things he talked about, following a process unemotionally, not getting caught up in echo chambers, really looking and doing the research, got oversight on that investment. Not just an index, because I think there's too many variables at play. And even a lot of these index shops, if you actually read between the lines, have said that some places index investing is really good, some places it's terrible. And I think when you start getting small, mid, emerging markets, fixed income and things like that, you kind of need some people that have a philosophy and a methodology to really dig through and go there and do the research. And that's also why it's helpful to have a firm that might have a shop locally there that can actually see what's going on in their economy and all of those variables.
So Barb, as we kind of wrap it up here, final thoughts from you.
I do believe in international investing. I think you should have a slice of your portfolio globally because, like Kirk said, we're about 45% of the investment world here in the US. And you want to have an opportunity to capture some of the other growth of businesses apart from the US. I'm Barbara Friedberg. You can find me at Barbara Friedberg Personal Finance on YouTube and at Robo Advisor Pros.
Thanks for coming on, Barb. Doug, final thoughts from you.
Well, first of all, the movie is called Blast from the Past, 1999 movie. Good movie. I recommend it. Kind of plays into some of the stuff we've talked about today. It's just kind of a good, entertaining movie. Second of all, we were talking about lifespan of companies. In 1996, there was about 7,300 domestic companies in the U.S. exchanges. By the end of 2017, there was only 3,600, a 50% decline. So we're seeing a lot less public companies. And the average time that a public company is actually listed in a lifespan on the S&P 500 has been shrinking from back in the 1960s. It was about 30 to 35 years. Now it's actually dropped to about 15 to 20. So you're just seeing a lot of turnover. The majority, 56% of that reasons is mergers and acquisitions, but 32% is failure, 12% other. So something that works well isn't going to work. So continue to apply a methodology and a process to all of this. If you want to learn more information about me, two areas, if you're a business owner and you want to run your company more effectively, he talked about startups, he talked about valuation, how to make your company actually run better. Can you pay yourself? Can you pay yourself a dividend? Can you pay yourself a fair wage as a business owner? If not, look us up at automaticbusinessmethod.com and get your business more efficient without spending tons of money to be able to find more profit, find more value. And again, if you have a family, I've talked about this before on a totally different topic. It has a high schooler, freshman to senior, looking to college. You can't afford not to have the information, get the help. College is getting more expensive and most people pay more than they have to. Look us up at procollegeplanners.com.
Doug, once again, thanks for coming on the show. And that's the show for this week. So thank you again for joining us in Money Tree Investing Podcast. My name is Kirk Chisholm, wealth manager of Innovative Advisor Group. We don't just manage your wealth, we make your life better. You can find more about me at innovativewealth.com. And of course, you can find me every week here on the show. Please remember to subscribe to the podcast on the podcast app if you're choosing. You can also check out the show at moneytreepodcast.com. On our website, you'll have access to the show notes, resources, and the archive shows. Also, we're now on YouTube, so please check out our YouTube channel. When you're there, please subscribe and leave a comment. Lastly, please leave a show rating and comment on the podcast app of your choice. Oh, and don't forget, do your own research. This show's for informational use only. We're not telling you what to think, merely how to think about investing. We're also not selling you any products or services, so do not consider this advice. If you have any problems with the show, I blame Putin, so please call him directly and express your feelings, assuming he's still around. If you're seeking financial advice, please talk to a financial advisor, oracle, or fortune teller. I'm a financial advisor, but as I said earlier, I'm not selling anything. But I'm easy to find. Have a great week ahead, and remember, no one will care about your money like you do. So invest in your life.
Thank you for listening to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Visit us at moneytreepodcast.com for more free investing resources.